flow of things, and that's because it's rally day. And as it's rally day, I felt it was appropriate that we would look at how Jesus interacted with kids. What sort of place and space did he create for them within his own ministry and his own community? And so this morning we've heard two different texts, two different stories of how Jesus welcomed children into his presence. Now we might read this and think, oh yeah, of course he does that. He's Jesus, he's awesome, he's loving of everybody. But what he was doing by welcoming and inviting kids into the community was very, very unusual. And yet Jesus made it a regular habit of not only inviting children, but inviting widows and orphans and tax collectors and prostitutes and all kinds of people to be present with him in his ministry. It's one of the things that frustrated the religious elite was that Jesus said to every ragtag person on the margins of society, he said, hey, come on, hang out with me. I don't know about you, but when I grew up, I always kind of had this image that it was Jesus and his 12 disciples, and it was just the 13 of them kind of going everywhere. And yet the reality is that Jesus had a whole group of people who traveled with him. He had roadies, he had groupies, he had people who were with him from the very beginning of his ministry all the way to the end. Wherever Jesus went, there was an entourage. And this entourage was filled with all kinds of people that other religious groups had clearly said, you are not welcome here. And Jesus said, oh, okay, come on down, come on down. And so before our text this morning, Jesus has just finished healing a young boy who was demon-possessed, and after healing him and taking time with him and his father, he heads back to Capernaum. And Capernaum is this little city in northern Israel, and if you were to take all of the stories about Jesus and plot them on a map, 90% of Jesus' life and ministry takes place within a 10-mile radius of Capernaum. Capernaum is home base. That is his center of his ministry, and he has a house in Capernaum. And so he finishes doing his ministry in one of the far little towns, and he journeys with this whole group of people, moms, kids, outcasts, everybody, and they make their way back to Capernaum, and they go to the house. So they weren't staying in a hotel. They were staying in somebody's home, which most likely had two rooms. You walked in, and there was like a little entryway where you'd take off your shoes and all that kind of stuff, and then you'd walk up a couple stairs, and there'd be a front room, which would have been the community room, and then you would have had the back rooms. So we can imagine this whole crew rolls into Capernaum. Everybody's there, and they make their way to the house, and so Jesus and his disciples sit down in that front room, and they make a little circle, and it's teaching time. So the women are getting the beds ready, they're getting the kids, you know, maybe they need a nap, they're trying to figure out food and all this kind of stuff, and Jesus is sitting down in the middle of this chaos and the craziness, and he makes a little circle, and he sits down with the disciples, and he says, so guys, what were you talking about on the long walk to Capernaum? And there is crickets. Because the whole time walking to Capernaum, they were arguing about who was going to be the greatest, who was more important than who, and Jesus knew this, of course, right? We do this as parents. Hey, what are you doing? Nothing. We know what they're doing, right? And so they realize, oh, he's on to us. What is he going to do? Is he going to chastise us? Is this another moment to be taught? And so Jesus snags a little kid who's right around the circle. And I just kind of imagine this kid's like peering in, trying to listen. What's Jesus saying? What's he saying? And next thing he knows, this young child is sitting in the middle of the circle of disciples. Now, to us, this doesn't feel weird, but to them, it would have been very, very uncomfortable. Most of Jesus' disciples were probably young men. They were not married, they didn't have kids, and taking care of kids was women's work back then. There was no co-parenting model available. These guys had no clue what to do with this little baby that's suddenly thrust into their midst. This kid does not belong in their world. Now, I can remember when Lydia was young, I invited a friend of mine over who was a young single man, no kids, not married, and so Dave comes in, and I say, oh, Dave, you want to hold Lydia? And she's, you know, teeny tiny, and the look in his face was like, dear God, don't make me touch that child. I'm like, okay, not going to hold the baby, that's fine. So we're having lunch, and I put her in her seat, and Lydia had this habit of choking when she would eat. She would just stuff as much food in as she possibly could, and so we'd gotten used to this, and so we're sitting talking, I'm having a conversation with Dave, and Lydia starts choking. So I'm still talking, pick her up, flip her over. Okay, she's good, food's out. And Dave is like, was she choking? Like, yeah, she's choking. He's like, does she do this regularly? And suddenly he's like, oh gosh, like I want nothing to do with kids. Kids are scary, they're breakable, they can't even eat their food right. And you could just see this fear in his eyes. And I imagine as the disciples are sitting there looking at each other with this little baby in their midst, they're looking at each other the exact same way Dave looked at me, which was like, oh my gosh, what is Jesus doing? Are we going to have to do like diaper duty? Like, are we being punished for talking about being the greatest? Like, are we on babysitting duty? Like, what are we doing? Like, this baby being in their presence was a source of punishment. Because in that day and age, babies were considered non-persons. And part of that is because so many babies never made it to adulthood. And so why get connected to this little person that is probably going to die? When we look at all the writings from the Roman Empire, and we have thousands and thousands of manuscripts, we have almost nothing written about children because children weren't worth the parchment to write about. They were not only to be seen but not heard, they were to be not seen and not heard. They were people who were socially obscure. And if they made it and survived to adulthood, then, you know, then they would be a person of value. But until they reached adulthood and could be contributing members of society, they had nothing to offer. In fact, it was so common that in the Roman world, if you were an older person and you needed an heir because you didn't have a child of your own, you would adopt an adult as your heir. You wouldn't adopt a child. Like, who wants to go through all the pain and the annoyance of raising a child and all the money? Just give me an adult to take over my finances someday when I die. That was the mindset that they had about children. It wasn't this Western American 21st century mindset where childhood is this age of innocence where everything's cute and wonderful. We have to document every single thing on our cell phones, right? We had Sam's first soccer game on Saturday, and it was like every parent and every grandparent had the cell phones out. I'm like, you guys, this is like their first six-year-old soccer game. It's okay. Like, there's going to be a lot more. But this is the mindset. Like, we've got to capture every moment. It's precious. It's sacred. It's beautiful. That was not the mindset. And so Jesus places this young child in the midst of this circle of young men who don't take care of babies, and they have no idea what to do. Nobody's getting down on their hands and knees saying, oh, let's do goo goo gaga or patty cake. Like, there's none of that. If they were modern day guys, I imagine that they would have taken out their cell phones and awkwardly sat there avoiding eye contact. You deal with the kid, not me. Jesus wanted them to welcome this child. The child was the lowest person in society. Here they are fighting and arguing about who's going to be the greatest, and they do this time and time again, and Jesus says, let's shift the conversation. Will you love this young child who I've brought into your midst? And none of them reach out to the kid. Jesus has to step into the circle and rescue the child, and he picks the kid up, and he holds it in his arms, and he says, look, if you can't welcome him, then you can't welcome me. And if you don't welcome me, then you're not going to welcome my Father. He's saying, if you want to love me, then you need to love children. And where you are a community that loves children, there the Spirit of the living God will be present. And he's not talking about tokenism. Like, okay, we got to make sure we have three kids in the crowd at all times because Jesus said we got to love children. No, he's talking about actually creating safe space for kids to be loved and valued and cherished and recognized as being created in the image of God. But the disciples aren't quite ready to do this. What he's saying is that this child actually has something to offer you. In many ways, children are much better disciples than the disciples Jesus had surrounded himself with. When we were in Nigeria 2 years ago, we had a friend whose name was Ishaya, and Ishaya was a tailor. You'll notice the shirt that I'm wearing is a little different than my normal repertoire. This was made by Ishaya. And Ishaya was this just kind and gentle Nigerian man. And he talked with a horrible stutter. And in Nigerian culture, if you talked with a stutter, something was wrong with you. God was punishing you. And so his whole life, he'd grown up on the margins, pushed to the side, because he could barely speak. He was a person of little value and of little status. And he grew up being told that every day of his life, every time he opened his mouth. You don't matter because you can't even speak right. And Shai came over to our house regularly, and he made us some clothes and things like that. and we got to know him, and we also found out that Ishaya was divorced. Now, in Nigerian culture, if you are a Christian and you get divorced, you get put under church discipline, because to get divorced is a sin. Now, Ishaya didn't want to get divorced. His wife did horrible things. You listen to his story and you thought, dear God, what this man has gone through. And then he finally gets a divorce and the church shames him and says, how dare you do this? He had been under church discipline for 7 years when we met Ishaya. He couldn't get up and read scripture. He couldn't lead worship. He couldn't be an elder in the church because he'd gotten divorced. Again, pushed to the margins, devalued, dehumanized, because of something that was completely not his fault. And the other thing that we came to learn about Ishaya was that he longed to be a father. He wasn't able to have kids, but he longed to be a father. And every time he came into our house, he would walk up to Sam and Lydia, and he would get down on their level, and he would talk to them. And this was totally out of the normal for Nigerian men. Nigerian men are strong and they're powerful, and the child should come up to the man and should greet the man. This idea that Ishaya would get down on their level, that he would speak to them, that he would engage them in conversation was scandalous. But Ishaya knew what it was like to be a person who didn't have value. And so he was willing to debase himself to love our two kids. And when we were getting ready to leave, Ishaya came over a couple days before we were getting on the plane. And Ishaya brought us some clothes that he'd made. Each one of us had some different clothes. And he gave Sam this little cute Nigerian outfit. And Sam looked at the outfit, he put it down, and he ran over to Ishaya. And Ishaya was sitting in a chair, and so he was about the same height as Ishaya. And he wraps his arms around Ishaya and just gives him this huge hug. And Sam is not a hugger. He's kind of like me. And Sam didn't just give him the thanks, release hug. Sam wrapped Ishaya in his arms, and he held on. And Ishaya wrapped his arms around Sam, and you just saw these big tears begin to roll down Ishaya's face. And there was this profound sense that we were on holy ground, that this is what the kingdom of God is about. Sam looked at Ishaya, and he didn't see a guy who stutters. He didn't see a guy who was divorced. He saw a man who loved him and cared for him and was thoughtful enough to bring him a gift, and that was all that mattered. None of the status stuff mattered, and he gave Ishaya a beautiful gift, the gift of a hug and the gift of love. When Jesus says, welcome the child, it's not just tokenism. It's welcome the child because we have something to learn from them. They have something of value to offer to us if we're willing to listen and pay attention. Jesus is desperately trying to get it through the heads of the disciples and the other people in that culture. Look, everybody has value. All are welcome. And he models that for the disciples time and time and time again, inviting all different kinds of people into his life and into his space. To me, it's so telling that he takes this child and puts him in the middle of the circle, and then he picks up the child. He says, don't just welcome these people and allow them to sit on the edges. And he says, no, welcome them right into the very center, into the heart, into the living spaces of your community. Jesus lived in a time during the Roman Empire where kids were regularly trafficked and sold into the slavery. All sorts of horrible things happened to children. What Jesus is saying is completely and utterly countercultural. He's challenging them to shift, and he's saying, look, you know, I'm not going to be able to go up to the Roman emperor and change the laws and change the rules, but what I can do is I can love the kids who are right here, right in front of me, right now. And he starts small with his own community. When I was in my early 20s, I had the opportunity to go to Thailand. And I went and I served with an organization called Word Made Flesh, and we were living in Bangkok, and we were working with women and children who had been trafficked into the red light district. Most of them were from Cambodia. They didn't have citizenship. They didn't have passports. Many of them were from multiple generations of folks who had been sold into the sex trade. And so the first night, we went down into the red light districts to see. And it was 10 p.m. when we started our way there. And I remember as we got closer to the red light district, there was this sense of darkness. that I cannot say I've experienced anywhere else that I've ever been. And as we were getting there, we saw all these little kids. And at this 10 p.m. at night, right, these kids should be asleep. They should be in bed. They should be going to school. But no, they're sleeping during the day to stay up at night because they can make enough money for their family to survive because of all the Western tourists who are coming through for sex tourism. And as we get closer to the red light district, we're standing on a corner, and we're waiting to cross the street, and there is a young child, probably 4 or 5 years old, who is laying on the ground prostrate with a wooden bowl in his hands for alms, and he is totally asleep. He's fallen asleep. He's so tired. And as we got into the main hub of the red light district, which ironically is called Soy Cowboy, which means Cowboy Street, the tourism, sex tourism industry started during the Vietnam War because of all the American soldiers coming back for R&R. We are the ones who started this. And all these kids came up to us in the missionary family that we were with. They started pointing out and helping us notice that a huge percentage of these kids had some sort of physical malformity or they were blind. And he said that's because their families will maim them at birth so that Western people will have pity on them and give them more money. And the farther we got into the red light district, just the more dark it became. Young faces lining the streets waiting for somebody to come by and scan the crowd and say, I choose you. Jesus knew that if we didn't value children, that this is the road that we would walk down. Jesus knew that. It's easy for us to hear these stories and to say, oh, that is such a shame. Those people in Thailand need to get their stuff figured out. Oh, that's such a shame that they did that back in the Roman world. That's a terrible, terrible thing. I'm so glad that children are treated better today. Nancy and I were at a presentation this week by an organization called North Star Ministries, which works right here in York and Lancaster, because we are a pass-through region for prostitution and sex tourism. And they told stories of kids in our country, in our backyard, 3 or 4 years old, being trafficked by their parents. Because this is not a historical problem. This is not a somebody out there problem. This is a real and present problem in our own world today. Fast forward to our second text. It's almost like a deja vu. Jesus is again sitting in the house in Capernaum with the disciples, and he's teaching them. And this group of mothers comes in with their children to be blessed by Jesus. And the disciples say, get out of here. Jesus doesn't have time for you. Don't you know your place? Get out of here. And Jesus, and I love this, this is the only time in the whole book of Mark, it says he becomes indignant, which means becomes angry at injustice. And Jesus rolls up his sleeves and he says, no. You disciples, you sit down because I do have time. Because these mothers and their children, they do have value and they are welcome into my presence. And he blesses every single child. Because when Jesus sees people who are marginalized and devalued and told that they don't have worth and dignity, he says, Bring them to me, and I will love them. Those who don't have a voice, let them come to me, and I will speak for them. And what he's saying to the disciples by modeling this is, and you should do the same. You should love the same. You should welcome the same. You should not sit back and be okay with the brokenness in the world around you and say, oh, that's a shame. Let me just pray for them and then walk away and do nothing. Jesus can't help himself. He's filled with righteous anger at the injustice that he sees. My prayer is that we too would be filled with righteous anger at the injustice in the world around us. It's not a foreign problem, it's an us problem. We've seen it on our own borders, right? Kids being denied access to beds and medicine and showers and soap. We violated the Geneva Convention, not Thailand. That's us. We know because of the Me Too movement, because of so many brave women who have shared their stories, that we live in a country that has a culture of taking advantage of the weak, of predatory behavior. We are the country with the highest rate of school shootings in the world. It's not a them problem. It's an us problem. And we are called to stand up and to do something, just like Jesus did. It's so easy, it can feel so overwhelming, right, with these big issues to say, well, what in the world can I do? How can I make a difference? You know, my $25 donation doesn't seem to matter. I don't have a lot of hours in my week. Lord, what can I do to make a difference? We can love the kids that we have right here. It was interesting when we were at this meeting, one of the questions I asked the lady who's presenting from North Star Ministries, I said, what can we do as men to help and be involved in this? And she said, you know what you can do is you can love your kids. You can teach them that they have value and dignity. If we want to make a change, then we got to start right here in our own community. It starts with 1,000 games of Go Fish, 100 putting together Lego projects, Sunday school morning, looking at a kid and saying, hey, what's your name? How's your week going? How's school been this year? Tell me one good thing that happened to you this week. Where have you seen Jesus? It starts with us loving small and building out from there. I don't know if you noticed all the kids who are up here this morning. We have an amazing crew of kids here. We are deeply and richly blessed with children. And as we're starting our new year, as Sunday school starts, as we get into the rhythm of life together as a congregation, my prayer for us is that we would love these kids fiercely. That they would walk out of here someday like Stephen and Morgan and Sarah walked out as college students, and they would know that they are always welcome. That in this space they are known by name, that they are loved, that they are cherished, that they have value. That even when things are broken and messy and ugly outside, that here becomes a space where God's love is pervasive and consistent. I don't know about you, but that feels like something that we can do. We may not fix sex trafficking, we may not fix all of these issues in the world, but we can start right here with the kids that we have been given. May we do that faithfully. May we do that with creativity and energy and passion. And may each one of these kids know that they are deeply loved. Let's do that together this year. Let's stand here a year from now and say, wow, what an adventure to love these kids well. What a gift to love them well. Let us do that together. Let us pray. God, thank you that you loved us when we were kids, that when we were far from you, you cherished us. Lord, may we take that same grace and love and care and compassion that we have received from you, and may we share that with others. We ask this in Jesus' holy and precious name. Amen.